This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. It's been a busy week in the Kentucky General Assembly. An effort to legalize casino gambling died on the Senate floor. The sponsor of a measure to regulate the sale of products containing meth precursor pseudoephedrine withdrew it from consideration, and debate continues over the Commonwealth's dropout age. Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston speaks with Rick Hallett to provide some perspective on what's happening in Frankfort.
The Kentucky Senate has dealt a blow to Governor Beshear's proposal to allow voters to decide via constitutional amendment if they want expanded gaming in the state. Was this vote yesterday a surprise?
You know, I don't think it was. There was a lot of buildup to it, but at the end of the day, I think a lot of people knew that the vote was going to be close and that it might not favor Governor Beshear. He even said himself in the lead-up to all this that, you know, while he thought he had the votes, obviously he wouldn't know until the roll call was called for that vote, and obviously when it was called, they fell well short of the votes they needed to pass that constitutional amendment out of the Senate.
I mean, they needed, what, 23 and they got 16?
That's right. In fact, David Williams, the state Senate president, pointed out that they didn't even get a majority of the Senate, which would have been, I think, 18 or 19 votes. So he kind of basically said, you know, the issue is dead. They didn't even get a majority of the votes. They didn't come close to getting what a constitutional amendment needs. So let's move on from this issue. It's been decided.
So this is over for this session? Nothing that can be like repackaged or represented, possibly?
Well, it always could be repackaged and represented. State Senator Damon Thayer, the Republican senator who sponsored the bill, says he's done with it for this session. He's not going to put it in as a floor amendment to any bill. He's not going to put it in as a committee sub or any other bill. That happens a lot in both chambers when lawmakers want a specific issue that they know won't pass. They'll kill other bills by filing their old bill that can't pass as an amendment. Thayer says he's not going to do that. House Speaker Greg Stumbo says that his chamber obviously is not going to take it up now that it's shown that it can't pass the Senate this session. It's dead for this session. Whether it's dead for good, you know, they've been discussing expanded gambling since 1994. So it's hard for me to believe that come 2013, there won't be some discussion about it again.
That's the perpetual issue in Kentucky.
Until they pass it, I guess.
That's right. So moving on to another topic. Now, you've been in the Kentucky Supreme Court. They've been hearing redistricting dispute has been presented to the court. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, that court ran pretty quickly. It was one of the quickest hearings I've ever heard. They were in and out in about 45 minutes. It's one of the shortest court hearings I've ever been to. Asked a few questions of the lawyers for Legislative Research Commission, LRC, and of lawyers for the House Republicans and State Senator Kathy Stein, who originally sued over the maps. And it was fairly quick. You know, the LRC lawyers basically want 2 decades of precedent out the window. They told the court, ignore it. You can set new precedent, and this is your chance to do so. And of course, lawyers for the House Republicans and Senator Stein were like, hold on a minute. There's no need to do that. This has worked just fine for 20 years. You know, you need to uphold this lower court ruling, and you need to tell the legislature to get back to drawing maps, and this time draw ones that are constitutional. And, you know, after meeting all day, the Supreme Court decided to issue a quick ruling this afternoon that says exactly that. They ruled the maps unconstitutional. They said that the legislature would have to use the 2002 maps, not the 2012 maps they drew this year, but maps from 10 years ago to run in legislative districts this year, and that they would have to draw new maps, of course, according to state and federal law because of the census, that would be for 2014 and on. So they could draw those maps in this session, but with only 25 roughly legislative days left and they haven't touched the budget, that seems a little unlikely. What's more likely is that they come back in January during what's called the short session during the odd years and try to pass a map for that because it gives them a little extra year to do that. But it was very interesting. The whole process with the Supreme Court took less than 12 hours today, and we already had a ruling on redistricting. So it's kind of a wild day when it comes to that issue.
One of the other hot-button issues is a proposal to require people who need pseudoephedrine to get a doctor's prescription in order to fight these meth labs. Where do we stand on that?
Well, it was kind of interesting. Before, we thought we were going to have one crazy Ringling Brothers circus type day in the Senate yesterday because we thought that they were going to take up this PSE bill, the pseudoephedrine bill, either before or after they did gambling. But surprisingly, State Senator Robert Stivers withdrew the entire bill before they even voted on the gambling bill. He says the debate's not dead, but he kind of conceded that having pseudoephedrine as prescription only, just that base statement, probably cannot pass the state Senate this year. So they're looking at some compromises, possibly some dosage limits. Of course, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has pushed this idea of having prescription only for convicted meth offenders, and having dosage limits for everyone, and not making it prescription only for everyone else. And so I don't know if they'll go that far, Senator Stivers will go that far, but they're looking at a few different options, and they'll probably run that bill through committee next week, and we'll have this debate all over again.
There's also a bill moving through that would create an alternative diploma for special needs students, and that's very close to winning final passage, isn't it?
Yeah, all it has to do is pass the state house. It shouldn't have any problem. It soared through the state senate. It's one of these bills that, you know, we talk about a lot of these issues that have that are divisive, that we don't know if they're going to pass or not. This one's really kind of been a slam dunk. It would create an alternative diploma and alternative standards for special needs students so that they can get a diploma. Right now, they only get a, kind of a certificate that said, yes, you were in school for this amount and you're done with high school. And this isn't for, you know, special needs students who obviously, you know, couldn't work a job or anything like that. These are for the ones that, you know, can probably work a job as an adult, who can function in society. And they want a diploma so that they can do that, so that they can get jobs, so that they can work, so they can be productive members of society. This bill would allow them to do that. There's probably going to be a House floor amendment that puts it into effect immediately for this year's graduating class. And it's really one of those bills that lawmakers are getting around and championing and saying, you know, this is good public policy.
Kenny Colston is the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You hear Kenny's reports daily during WKMS Newscast. You can find his online stories at news.wkms.org. And later in the program, with Murray State President Dr. Randy Dunn, we again focus on Frankfort politics and how that may affect the higher education system's budget in the near future, and what that means for adding the private University of Pikeville to the ranks of public universities in the state. A traveling exhibition from the Smithsonian Institution called Journey Stories is at Murray State's Rather West Kentucky Museum through March 10th. We asked our listeners for their journey stories. We received this one from Mary Ann Littleton, who's a Murray native. Littleton's journey story is about her spiritual pilgrimage to Tibet and Nepal in her 51st year.
I suppose journeys are always inner and outer, but maybe I didn't really realize it till I went on what is considered a pilgrimage. Parts of 2010 and 2011 were spent in the land of origin of the spiritual path I was starting to commit myself to: Nepal, India, Sikkim, and Tibet. My trip to Nepal, Darjeeling, and Sikkim from October to December 2010, although I didn't know at the time, was sort of a warm-up for Tibet the next summer, where I did the Kailash Kora. Kailash is the holiest of mountains for Hindus, Buddhists, Bons, and Jains, more so than Everest, where you circumambulate the base of the rectangular mountain at some 15 to 17,000 feet. The trip to Tibet was truly a trip of a lifetime, and one I hope to repeat someday. But because of the heavy Chinese control, we could not deviate from our permitted plans, and after 6 weeks of having a guide with me at almost every step of the way, I really longed to just move about by myself. In Nepal, I arrived in Parping, just as a Vajra Kalaya Drupchen was about to begin at a nearby monastery. I was urged to take part, as it seemed Vajra Kalaya was just the sort of medicine I needed. The practice helps remove obstacles, and it seemed I was experiencing quite a few in my life. The Drupchen was a major treat. An English woman and I, alongside 100 or so Tibetan and Nepali monks of various ages and powerful Rinpoches, sitting in a magnificent temple for 10 days, transported to the Tibetan sacred world of ritual dance, music, and mantra, with bells, horns, drums, colorful masks, costumes, incense, marching our way through battle with our inner and outer demons. i.e., in Tibetan Buddhist terms, our dualistic tendencies. I also made a pilgrimage to a remote area in Nepal called Maratika, taking a 12-seater Nepali airline flight where they give you cotton balls to muffle the engine sound. And then once we landed on a fairly level grassy spot in the foothills of the giant Himalayas, I jumped on a motorbike for another 20 miles, struggling to hang on and wondering why he got to wear the only helmet. I was really out in the middle of nowhere. Maratika was a lesson in living with uncertainty. Would I make it? Would I ever make it back? It seems I'd already experienced this as a Peace Corps volunteer some 25 years ago. But as they say, youth is wasted on the young, and at 51, this lesson had a lot more meaning. I went there to visit the famous caves where a magician, Padmasambhava, who is credited with taming the wild spirits of Tibet and Nepal so Buddhism could flourish, stayed with his equally famous consort, Mandarava. I really have never been a cave person, and since these were not well kept, I really didn't spend that much time in them. I chose to spend my time hiking the numerous trails and just admiring the landscape. One day, I hiked straight down to the rushing Himalayan ice-cold river with banana trees along the shore and back up slowly, huff, huff, passing through little hamlets and encountering people working in their fields. One, a little old woman, seeing me and exclaiming, "Rama, Rama," sort of our, "Oh my God, what is this woman doing here?" What is most important about journeys is what happens when you come back, where the journey leads. A journey across the world leads to a journey back in familiar habitat with eyes anew. Yes, I was transformed. In some ways, I'm aware of now, and in many ways, things are still unfolding. The outer and inner landscapes continue to work their magic on many different levels. As the Tibetans say, on outer, inner, and secret levels.
Murray native Mary Ann Littleton contributed this journey story about her spiritual pilgrimage to Tibet and Nepal in her 51st year. It's part of a limited series on WKMS that highlights a traveling exhibition from the Smithsonian Institution called Journey Stories. It's at Rather West Kentucky Museum at 16th and University Drive on the Murray State campus through March 10th. Hours are 8:30 to 4, Monday through Friday, and 10 to 1 on Saturdays. And coming up on Front Page Sunday, we hear from Murray State professor Steve Jones. He was one of the first African-American professors hired at Murray State, and he's retiring now after 35 years of service. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe. This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. A year after the 1954 U.S. Supreme Court decision Brown v. Board of Education, Murray State University welcomed its first African-American students to class. But it wasn't until 1977 that the school hired its first African-American faculty. Dr. Steve Jones is chair of MSU's Department of Sociology, and he was among those first hired 35 years ago. Dr. Jones is retiring at the end of the semester, and he sat down with Shelley Baskin to talk about what he experienced during his Murray State tenure.
I had just finished my dissertation research, which the location was Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was on my way back to St. Louis, where I was working on my doctorate degree at Washington University. So I stopped in Mayfield because my mother's sister at that time lived in Mayfield. And I should say, too, that this sister, my aunt, was more like a second mother. So when I found out that she wasn't doing very well, I decided that I wanted to stay around and just help her out. So I began to look for a job. I had 7 years of teaching experience at that point, college teaching experience, so I came to Murray.
What kind of culture did you find at Murray when you started working? Were the students and faculty fairly ready to accept you, or was there some animosity?
There were a few experiences where animosity, dislike, prejudice, whatever term you want to use, was operative. But for the most part, my experiences could be described in terms of discomfort, discomfort that people had with me and discomfort that I had with them. Because keep in mind the history here, this was the first time that Murray State had hired African-American faculty. African-American students had only been here since 1955. People weren't necessarily mean-spirited.
Over the years, did you notice changes happening rapidly as far as the feelings of awkwardness and discomfort kind of disappearing, or is that something that's still around now?
We probably have to acknowledge that this feeling of discomfort, it probably varies as you move from one black faculty person to another, from one time period to another. I think overall, my impression was that the level of comfort increased as the number of African-American students increased, as the number of African-American faculty increased. But there were also things that were changing on the campus itself. So I think as some of these things began to change, the atmosphere on campus changed. And this is not to say we still don't have some ways to go, but the atmosphere did become more comfortable.
You're now a department chair here at Murray. What was your road like? What led up to you taking that position?
The first opportunity that I had as far as administrative experience was handed to me by Dr. Joe Cartwright. Professor Cartwright was the dean of our college, and our department chair at that time went to Australia for a semester. So Dr. Cartwright gave me the opportunity to be the acting chair. So that was the first administrative experience that I had, and it was important in my career. The big break came after we moved into the College of Health Sciences and Human Services, which was started in 2000. Dr. Betty Blodgett, who was the first dean of College of Health Sciences and Human Services, Dr. Blodgett, after the resignation of our then chair, called each department faculty member in and asked them one-on-one what they thought they needed in terms of the kind of person we wanted as chair. So when I went in and had my discussion, she said, I noticed that you didn't apply for the chair's position. And my response to her was, well, Dr. Blodgett, I'm not sure that Murray State is ready for its second black chair in the history of the university. And I also mentioned to her, which I guess was news, that I had converted to Islam. Not a black Muslim, not a member of the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. I am a Muslim, and I converted right here on this campus. So Dr. Blodgett sort of reared back in her chair when I said those things about first black chair and being a Muslim. She said, I don't think that makes any difference. I want you to think about it. So I did think about it, and I decided that I would throw my hat in the ring, and she selected me as the chair, and I've held that position for about a decade.
Well, overall, what's your experience been? You said you're planning on retiring here soon. Has this been a good experience or a rough one?
Well, there have been trials and tribulations, as I think there always is. Life is a struggle. But I've had some really good experiences. I guess I would single out my relationships in the classroom, my relationships with students have been and continue to be just one of the very exciting and fulfilling parts of my life. Students have, for the most part, been very accepting and understanding. And on some occasions, in some time periods, I've said to myself that maybe my students know me best of all.
Dr. Jones, thank you for talking to me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Last year, local residents glazed hundreds of bowls in preparation for the Empty Bowls Project, a charity event in Paducah organized by ceramic artist Michael Terra. When the handmade bowls are ready, patrons purchase a $15 ticket and fill them with food donated from local restaurants. All of the proceeds benefit the Paducah Community Kitchen. With the second annual Empty Bowls event approaching, Casey Northcutt takes a look at one woman who spent the past year glazing bowls for the project. She says in doing so, she's nourished her own soul.
Yeah, this is all about chemistry.
In a room cluttered with bottles and brushes, a woman stares at a small clay bowl. The bowl has three legs protruding from its base that give it the appearance of a cauldron. Picking up a paintbrush, Joanne, or Joe Dorch, decides it needs a pair of pants.
Each bowl tells you what to do with it by its shape and whatever is the structure in the bowl. You just sort of listen to the bowl and it'll tell you what to do.
So what's this bowl telling you to do?
Make a pair of overalls.
For the past year, Dorch has shown up about once a week at Michael Terra's ceramic studio, Terra Cottage, in Paducah. She spent that time in self-imposed art therapy, shaking up bottles of glaze and applying coats to clay pottery used in the Empty Bowls project. Terra says he has seen many people find emotional calm in the act of transforming a piece of clay.
It's very quiet. It's very forgiving. And so I think that as people take a breath and allow that to unfold, it's a pretty, for lack of a better word, spiritual moment.
For Dorch, glazing has brought her back from emotional and mental collapse. The 69-year-old woman first walked through Terra Cottage's door in December 2010 to paint a piece for Empty Bowls. At the time, she suffered from emotional and physical exhaustion that quickly approached a breaking point. The day after Christmas that year, she suffered a major breakdown.
I just sat there. I mean, I couldn't think and I couldn't react to things.
Dorch says after years of constant caregiving, she snapped. She had been experiencing family ordeals that began in 1989 when her father died and she quit her job to take care of her elderly mother. Then, in the past 11 years, doctors diagnosed her husband with diverticulitis and later an aortic aneurysm and esophageal cancer. Her brother and 5-year-old granddaughter also developed cancer. And through it all, Dorch helped where she could. But eventually, she collapsed. Her daughter, Terry Clark, grew alarmed.
She just got to give up more and more of herself to the point where there wasn't anything left for her. And then it all escalated to the point of her not functioning at all and being hospitalized several times, and they couldn't find any physical reasons. It turned out that it was just all stress and depression.
Yet after the 2010 Christmas season, the innately creative Dorch continued to glaze at Terra Cottage. Michael Terra says she visited several times before he invited her to come weekly. He realized it had started to change her. Dorch first glazed because she felt a responsibility to help the hungry in Paducah. But as she continued, she realized her stress had started to slip away. She had found a method of self-expression she could perform in a quiet space where no one would need her. Back in the ceramic studio, Dorch paints overall straps that run over the lip of her bowl. She smiles as she describes the kindness Michael Terra and his family have shown her over the past year. Terra Cottage has become something of a sanctuary.
Do you have a favorite bowl that you've glazed?
No, I don't think that way. I think of doing artwork is like you just evolve from one into another. I try to be mindful of just the present because I'm just a conduit for what's going on here. I don't take credit for it. I just sort of plug in and try to really see and feel what's happening. And then the next time, maybe you've learned something from that other time.
Today, Dorch's granddaughter, brother, and husband live cancer-free, and therefore so does she. After her breakdown, Dorch has learned to delegate responsibility, which now eases her everyday burdens. But pottery gives her access to creative expression. It gives her an activity to perform for herself. Well, for herself and for hungry people in Paducah. For WKMS News, I'm Casey Northcutt.
Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make
The University of Louisville, according to the U.S. Department of Education, earned a $16 million profit for its basketball team in the 2009-2010 season. That's a significant difference for smaller mid-major schools like Murray State. But MSU is in the middle of an historic Cinderella story season. We hear more about potential revenue from this season from MSU President Dr. Randy Dunn. We can't deny the significant impact that Racer basketball is having not only on the university but on our community right now.
It's been a wonderful season, hasn't it? Everywhere I go on behalf of the university or even just when Rhonda and I may be out personally or for a social event, it is the talk of all of Western Kentucky, and it's just been a joy to be part of it.
In a recent interview with NPR's Only a Game, you mentioned an uptick in student applications. How did you connect student application, an increase in student applications, to our basketball success?
Well, what I had shared with the reporter at that time when that interview took place was the fact that at the university, we're really trying to take the best advantage that we can, and I mean that in a very positive way, not in that we're trying to game the system, if you will, but we're trying to take the best advantage we can to use the success of Racer basketball to elevate the prominence and the stature of a university as a whole. One of the things that you hear said about college athletics is that it's a front door or a front porch to everything else that happens to be going on at an institution. And we've wanted to take that to heart and really use this opportunity we've been provided with the success of men's basketball team in ways that benefited Murray State. So back to the question, as I talked to this interviewer, I mentioned the fact that we're looking to move in every place we can to forward the success of the university as a whole beyond just the basketball team. That is to say, with the bookstore and with our online apparel shop, we're pushing out T-shirts every time there's a change in rankings or in the case of Dick Vitale coming to town, selling T-shirts around that event, increasing profits to the bookstore, which in turn we use to support student services on campus. The revenue from the bookstore actually is plowed back into the services we provide directly to our students. We're obviously reconnecting with donors who we haven't heard from for some number of years. We're getting these requests literally from around the country to come back to campus, to make a contact with a donor many times, who we've kind of lost track of over the years. And the giving that we're going to see come out of this season is really going to be quite notable, given the indications that we have to this point. So then another thing I mentioned to the question that you pose is the fact that we also feel that we're getting a pretty significant bump in admissions for next fall's entering class based upon the numbers that we're seeing now. At this point, when we look at the entering class for fall of 12, we're up about 300 admissions over where we were at this period 1 year ago. Now, it's true that we've done a lot of things to change up our enrollment strategies and to work in more directed ways around recruiting, and as part of that, we folded in social media, all of these things that we've really been trying to implement to build enrollment at Murray State over the past 3 years. But the bulk of that work had already taken place. There hasn't been that much different going on in the past years to account for the fact that we're up in admits by 300. So I do have to attribute a good chunk of that to the national notoriety that we've been able to achieve through our basketball prowess this year. And as I'm out talking to different groups, whether it's student groups in schools or getting email from potential students, which I actually do a lot, I'll hand out my card everywhere to parents or prospective students, and oftentimes we'll get a letter or email back. And we're hearing from folks in places where it just wouldn't be usual to get the level of interest we're seeing. And the only thing I can say is that all this attention, all the publicity that's come to Murray State from the basketball success has to be a driver for that in some fashion.
When you receive the new revenue that comes in from the basketball season, how's that divvied up?
Well, if I tried to explain the formula, I'd probably end up getting all tongue-tied with you and embarrass myself, if nothing else. But I'll try to give you kind of a simplified version. Essentially, when a team goes into the tournament, for every game played, there is a share that comes both to the institution as well as to that institution's conference for getting a game. So obviously, if you win, you get a second game. You're going to get that second share that comes given whatever a unit happens to be worth for that given year in the tournament. And the idea there is then that revenue comes to you not just in one year. So there'll be a share that's paid, and this is going to be a fairly significant share in the tens of thousands of dollars typically for every game appearance in the NCAA tournament. But it is spread out over time. So instead of coming to you all in one big payment, that payment comes over a period of 6 years. And again, part of that is shared conference-wide with the institutions that are there. So if you look at what success has been happening over the past couple of years, Murray State, of course, in 2010 had two game appearances. We had that first win over Vanderbilt, mm-hmm. leading us to the Butler game out in San Jose. So that gave us two appearances. Morehead State had a very successful run. That helped. We hope that we're in, if not to the Sweet 16 at least, maybe even beyond that. So all of those shares accumulate and are paid out over a six-year period. So we're going to see a significant increase in revenue from the NCAA tournament appearances that also goes beyond T-shirt sales, sold-out CFSB Center, and the things that come along with that level of success. Now, the challenge becomes using that or stewarding those extra resources in such a way that we're able to build the program with it. We don't overextend ourselves, which is always the challenge of a mid-major, but to ensure that we're plowing an appropriate amount of that back into support of the program to keep the success we've had sustained over time. And not just for men's basketball, obviously, but to support all of our athletic endeavors at the university. And we do try to be very thoughtful and careful in the way we approach the use of that additional revenue to build all of our programs.
So it stays within the athletic department.
Well, it comes to the general fund of the university. But as that windfall, if I can use that term, is made available to us, I sit and talk with our vice president for financial and administrative services, Tom Denton, our athletic director, Alan Ward, others who are working on the budget to figure out, all right, with this money coming in to the general fund, what is the best and highest use we can make of that, not only for supporting men's basketball, but racer athletics generally, as well as the university as a whole. The idea that I think is important, particularly for a place like ours, is that there's an opportunity for the entire institution to benefit from the success that we're able to have.
And so there's no income from any television network for receiving, you know, national coverage on ESPN.
Income that comes generally comes into the conference and is divided on a share basis with the member institutions. But again, I would come back to say, for all of these different sources of funding, these avenues for revenue, we look at that as a whole as it comes to the general fund and try to make some very good decisions about where to use that additional money or that overage that we wouldn't have expected in an average year, let's say, to move the ball forward in a lot of areas.
So as we talk about revenue coming into the university from athletics, where does Murray State stand on athlete compensation?
Well, you're raising an issue that for this segment, I may fill the remaining time in it. You may be referring to, Chad, to an NCAA proposal that would have provided $2,000 per student athlete to help in covering the additional costs of attendance for a student athlete to attend school. Now, there was a proposal that went up through the NCAA. It was overridden. Now, this is a whole other area that I could get into and probably get myself in trouble, but you really need to be a Philadelphia lawyer to understand how the NCAA gets decisions made within its governance structure. But that being said, there was a proposal to provide this $2,000 per student athlete that would have been up to the institutions and conferences to help cover unmet costs. Some saw that as a pay-to-play type of proposition. I will share with you that I didn't. For the typical student athlete, there are unmet needs that attach to coming to school, sometimes at a place far from your home, as is the case with a number of our men's basketball players mm-hmm. this year, to give you a good example, that can't be covered from any other sources. We can't have donors obviously putting money in their pockets and that type of thing. So I don't view what the NCAA tried to do as a pay-to-play proposition. I do think we have many athletes who do have unmet needs after we apply the aid that we do provide. And I think it was worth taking a look at. Now, obviously, there was great concern among Division I institutions around the country because they shut that proposal down. And we may see that come back in the future in some different form. But this notion that that's just a crazy thing to think about, or we're just, you know, giving salaries to student athletes, I think really doesn't do a service to what the NCAA and a number of member institutions were trying to accomplish with that proposal. The average student athlete is not driving around in a fancy car and, you know, living in a penthouse and things like that. Even though all of the scholarship and aid support can be provided, there are still things that do not get covered for those student athletes, and this was simply an attempt to try to address that. The Division I membership spoke and said they weren't supportive of it as it stands. So I think you're going to see NCAA leadership go back to the drawing board and think about how to maybe revise this proposal and come back with it again. And I think that's probably not a bad idea.
We'll be back with Murray State President Dr. Randy Dunn in a moment. We're back with Murray State President Dr. Randy Dunn. We meet monthly and talk about all things higher education and Murray State, and you can hear this conversation on our website, wkms.org. We continue to talk about the goings-on in Frankfurt. The governor is putting together a two-year biennial budget. He's made the address, which includes a 6.4% cut to higher education, which could account to $3.2 million at Murray State University. And because that budget is not in stone and could be changed, first I wanted to know if you've heard that anything might be different as it passes through chambers.
No, we really haven't had anything new to share from last month when we talked on this. I think I shared at the time in that interview that I felt fairly sure that we weren't going to see things change too much from the governor's original budget proposal. The reason for that being there just aren't a lot of degrees of freedom to move around and change the budget picture. So while there may be some tweaking or a little bit of changing here and there, I really anticipate that at the end of the session, when we get an enacted budget eventually, we're going to see it cutting our state support still at about that $3.2 million level. Nothing has come on the horizon in the month since we've talked last that makes me, you know, think differently about that. In fact, maybe I'm even now more cemented in my belief that we're going to be stuck with this hit.
And you've mentioned on this program that Murray State will be able to weather this cut with various different cost adjustment measures.
Right. We're going to get through for a year. Now, when I said we'll weather the cut, what I meant was we will weather this for 1 year. And instead of doing kind of a ready, fire, aim approach to changing all kinds of things at the university, we do have the ability with reserves, with a modest tuition increase, and with some quick cost savings. There's not a lot of quick cost savings left. You may recall, Chad, that heading into FY09, fiscal year 09, we did a little over $2 million in cuts at that time, and that took care of all the easy cuts, all the low-hanging fruit, if you will. But we can still wring out a little more cost savings, and on that basis, we'll get by okay for 2012-13 without making drastic changes in the face of the university, our operations, programs, and services. However, we're going to use that year of cushion, as I mentioned last time we talked, to put together probably four or five budget planning teams. These will be broad groups inclusive of all constituencies of the university to take a look at some changes we will have to make and really take on some very careful study to come forward with some recommendations about a year from now that will change our financial model, our business plan, if you will, and have that hit come 2013-14 at the university. So we buy a year to kind of think through carefully what to do maybe in changing services, academic programs, getting some organizational efficiencies, generating alternative forms of revenue. We'll look at all of that through the course of the next 8 to 12 months with the idea of bringing forward recommendations to our board about a year from now when we're doing the FY14 budget that will probably have us looking somewhat different at Murray State University.
And you mentioned in that answer about a modest tuition increase.
Right.
And it depends on the Council on Post-Secondary Education as to how much you can increase tuition to cover this cost without, you know, burdening your students and their families.
Right.
Have you received a straight answer from the CPE? We've heard about testimony from President Robert King.
Right.
That it would be no more than 7%. Does that mean it's a 6% tuition increase?
If I had a crystal ball, maybe I could be better at answering this question about where the CPE is going. Now, you are right. It was reported in the news that Bob King gave testimony, I believe, to a House Budget Subcommittee that throughout this 7% increase as a possibility of what the council was looking at. He's since kind of retracted or backpedaled on that statement to some degree, I think. Now we're hearing something considerably less than that. So I would probably submit to you, you'll just need to talk to the CPE to be able to divine where they may be at this point in time on that question. I'm going to advocate we're given the opportunity to think closer to 7 than away from that, something under 5, which is one number I've also heard bandied about. For where our pricing sits at Murray State University and what that would turn into for a dollar amount, I don't think it is untoward for us to be in that vicinity. But given the regulatory environment or the statutory environment in Kentucky, we're really kind of at the behest of the CPE, and they're not even going to set this until April 21 when they meet. So we can't wait for them. We've got to move forward in doing our budget planning, in communicating with our students. And right now we're kind of doing our budget building, looking at this, you know, 5 to 7% range as a point we're working from. We'll be glad when the CPE in April finally makes their determination. That'll give us then some certainty going forward.
Another issue that we've talked about briefly that's going on in the legislative session related to higher education involves the University of Pikeville.
Yes.
And we've aired a program from Kentucky Educational Television, mm-hmm. Kentucky Tonight, where the entire hour was devoted to the possibility of the University of Pikeville becoming a public institution,
yes,
using coal severance funds mm-hmm. to finance that institution with the state support.
At least initially, mm-hmm. they would be going to that. One of the things, though, I think, Chad, that anyone would have to acknowledge is that over time, there will be funding from the general fund of the Commonwealth of Kentucky to support a University of Pikeville that was in the state system. Now, the coal severance may be the starting point so that they're able to pull their tuition down from about $17,000 where it is now to roughly $7,000, $6,000 to $7,000 that they're talking about. And the coal severance would allow them to do that. But there will be a host of other needs that are shared by the other publics that I would assume University of Pikeville would look to the state's general fund to support, just like all of the other public institutions do.
But one of the public institutions came out against,
yes,
the possibility of Pikeville University becoming a state institution,
yes,
and that's another Eastern Kentucky University, Morehead State.
Right.
And I believe they had a resolution that their board adopted,
yes,
against allowing the University of Pikeville to
that's
become
correct
a state institution.
Yes.
Do you get the sense that that is the sentiment of other state universities?
Well, I know that there has been some outreach on the part of the Morehead State Board and President to make a contact with some of the other public universities, if not all of them, in the Commonwealth to seek support, even possibly by joining them in this resolution. Now, we probably do need to acknowledge, Chad, that Morehead State likely has the most to lose, if we want to phrase it that way, from University of Pikeville coming into the state system in creating this Southeast Kentucky district that's being proposed as kind of the regional service area for Pikeville would be coming from Morehead State's assigned service area. I think there are roughly 107 or so students who would be coming out of Morehead State, probably right out of the gate, and likely going to the University of Pikeville based upon their location and that type of thing. Again, this is speculative. But obviously, they'd take some enrollment hit immediately and probably going forward have a tougher time recruiting, obviously, if there's a state-supported institution within that Pikeville regional area. Now, all that said, I understand then why they're talking to the other institutions and trying to get others to sign on and endorse this resolution they've passed. I don't sense that we're going to see a lot of the other state institutions or the boards of regents or trustees taking this on. I think where influence is trying to be wielded or shared, it's probably done more quietly and privately. This is becoming a bit of a flashpoint issue. You and I have been watching the papers of late, and we're starting to see these sides getting drawn and a polarization effect taking place. And I don't think any board and certainly the presidents of the public institution want to get caught in that type of scenario.
And of course, there's a feasibility study ongoing.
That's right.
That will determine, again, the feasibility of adding Pikeville University to
right.
the state institution,
right.
along with the legislation that's moving through the General Assembly.
That's right. And I've had a chance, as all the presidents have, to talk to the researchers who have been hired, the consultants, to come in and do this study, and been able to point out some things to them that we feel absolutely have to be looked at in this. And you're starting to pick up now in Frankfurt an understanding that when you get beyond the surface and start to look at the nature of the buildings over at Pikeville and the deferred maintenance that needs to take place, some accreditation concerns that they're working through, debt loads, all of those things that below the surface people maybe don't think about or know about, as that starts to really get scoured through, I think that report could be helpful in giving a truer picture of what's going on at the University of Pikeville. In one sense, you can't argue with kind of the general political argument that folks, advocates, are making in favor of UPike coming into the state system. It's kind of like mom and apple pie. On its face, it does make sense, and it's a good argument, but there are a lot of other considerations, again, these things I've mentioned, that I think the state of Kentucky has to do its due diligence on before making the decision for Pikeville to come into the system. And I do think that work is trying to be accomplished as we speak. The question is, can all of that get churned through now that we're about halfway through the legislative session? And we'll see.
Well, Dr. Dunn, we're out of time.
Thanks, Chad.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Seth Helton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on the front blog and our Facebook page, and there are links to both at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Join us Friday morning at 8:35 for Front Page AM, and Friday evening at 6:30 for Front Page PM. Thanks for listening.